welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Max Tillman, and coming up on the program...
I came up on the bridge and everyone was white, and I was like, oh, what's happened? And out the back window were just being circled for the last half an hour by 12 pirate skiffs.
It's a hopeful return to smooth sailing in the Suez Canal, with Taiwanese owned tanker Ever Given finally refloated. But what has the blockage unstuck in the world's supply chains? And will all roads continue to lead to the canal? Also on the show...
It has been a big concern. It remains a big concern. And of course, the recent lockdown in Brisbane didn't help. It introduced further uncertainty and it certainly put the fear into tourism operators across Queensland.
There's never been a better time to fly, according to the federal government, with Canberra's subsidised half-price flights for interstate destinations currently on sale. But with Brisbane's surprise lockdown breakout before the Easter long weekend, it could be time to rebook those Sunshine State trips. All this and more coming up on The Money. First, last month, ground was broken on a 720-megawatt solar farm in the New England region. The $600 million New England solar farm is one of many industrial-sized solar farms across New South Wales, with investments soaring recently thanks to the designation of renewable energy zones. But as renewables continue to rise, it is unclear whether the electricity transmission network, designed for coal in the 1950s, can handle all that power. Toby Hemmings has the story.
It's another sunny day in Urala, just outside of Armidale in the New England region. 3 kilometres out of town, construction has begun on the New England Solar Farm, the new project from UPC AC Renewables. Killian Wentrop, head of solar development, explains...
We're very excited to have recently commenced construction of Stage 1 of New England Solar Farm, which is a 400-megawatt solar farm project. So this is a development that's been roughly 3.5, nearly 4 years in the making. Stage 1, as I mentioned, is 400 megawatts. We also plan to build Stage 2, which is 320 megawatts. And once the 720 megawatts is constructed, that will be enough clean renewable energy for around about 250,000 New South Wales homes.
There are currently 16 solar farms across New South Wales, with solar making up 12% of the total energy mix. The New England Solar Farm will be set to increase that share.
The 400 megawatt stage one, if that were online today, it would be definitely the biggest solar farm in Australia. Certainly, even when it's online in a couple of years, it will be a very significant size project.
New England is a prime location for solar farming. It might not have the sunniest climate, but it benefits from being geographically higher up, whilst maintaining a fairly cool ambient temperature, meaning that energy can be produced via solar panels with greater efficiency. The community has also been receptive to the project.
The landholders that we first approached were very open to talking to us. There's a history of renewable energy in New England. You might be familiar with some of the wind farms up around Glen Innes. So people were very attuned to renewable energy, and there was already some sort of discussion sniffing around, if you like, going on in the area. So we came in at a good time where people were already familiar with renewables. They knew what the opportunities meant. We're absolutely, you know, committed to making sure that some benefits flow back to the local community in a very direct way. And by the time the full project is operational, it'll be close to $200,000 per annum being made available for local initiatives.
All of these factors play into why the New England region was designated as one of 3 renewable energy zones by the New South Wales government. $13 billion is expected to be invested in renewable energy generation in the region over the next 5 years. But there is another factor at play.
The things that really attracted UPC to looking at doing a project in this area were firstly the transmission capacity available on the grid when we started investigating a potential project in the area was quite favourable. It's also a relatively robust part of the network compared with what we call in the industry being at the end of a long skinny line somewhere at the, you know, the fringe of the grid. This is certainly not the fringe of the grid. It's part of the backbone of the eastern seaboard grid.
Transmission is a critical consideration in renewable energy. It's one thing to be producing power. It's another to get it from point A to point B.
The system we see today largely was designed to do those two things. Large centralised fossil fuel-based power stations, or in two cases, large hydro, connected by long-distance transmission lines to balance the grid. And that was a very different world from the one we're imagining in the future.
Tony Wood, the Program Director for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute, explains how the shift to renewable energy makes energy production more mobile.
By comparison with coal-based or even gas or even hydro, these renewable energy projects don't depend to the same extent on those economies of scale. That is, you optimise the size of the wind turbine or the size of the solar panel, and then just lay them out. Broadly speaking, you're not constrained to where the coal is or where the gas is. You can basically build them wherever the wind is or the sun is. We've certainly seen a lot of wind farms particularly, and more recently solar farms built around that concept.
What has made New England and other renewable energy zones feasible for further investment was the fact that there is existing capacity in the network to transmit this additional energy. Tony Wood explains what capacity means in this context.
It's a bit like when you think about the transmission grid, it's a bit like a highway. There's only going to be, you know, if you build a two-lane highway, there's only a certain amount of capacity to deal with cars. As the traffic increases, you might have to add 2, 3, 4 multiple lanes of traffic, and once you do that, the capacity increases. Now, the same thing happens with electricity and even gas transmission lines. The problem, of course, is, as with a congested highway, at a point you get to, there's just not enough room left. And so the only answer is either go somewhere else or increase the capacity or to take in more generation. The renewable investment that's been made over the last 20 years was made where there was capacity on the transmission grid, a grid which was designed to send electricity from the middle out, not from the out in.
New South Wales's transmission infrastructure was designed in the 1950s with the specific goal of pushing electricity from coal-fired power plants in the Hunter to populous areas like Sydney. As renewable energy production means that energy can come from more diverse locations, Tony Wood argues that a new approach to the energy transmission is required.
It's no different from saying, how do you coordinate the building of the roads with the building of the homes and the factories? It's a very practical problem. It's not beyond the ken of humankind or human ingenuity to redesign it, but because the system was never designed this way and we've never thought about electricity this way, it is requiring a substantial change of thinking and a very different way of the way we go about planning our transmission system.
Matt Keane, New South Wales's Energy and Environment Minister, is pushing for $32 billion in private infrastructure investment in renewable energy over the next decade. With construction such as the New England solar farm underway, while coal plants age out of use, the stage is set for New South Wales to become a renewable superpower. But is the transmission network ready?
The answer is not very ready. We're better than we were, but we're not as good as we need to be. And so we have seen in very recent times, we've seen some renewable energy generators connect to the grid and find that they're constrained in terms of how much electricity they can send into the system. So I think this new system of distributed generation, which is also affected by weather conditions, and obviously with solar, whether the sun's up or down, that sort of system is going to be more dependent upon this transmission grid for moving electricity around than we've had in the past. We'll have to get a damn sight better, closer to being right than we've had in the past.
The sun is still shining, but there's work to be done.
Toby Hemmings, ending that report. The Evergreen ship has officially been unstuck after a week of blocking the Suez Canal, one of the most important trade routes in the world. However, the extent of how long it will take businesses to recover from the delays in supply chains remains largely uncertain. Sophia Tarek has the story.
For the past 6 days, Taiwanese container and shipping company Evergreen has had one of its ships, the Ever Given, stuck on a channel of the Suez Canal near Egypt. While the ship is now free, the Suez Canal Authority has valued the loss and damages from the blockage at an estimated $1 billion. The chairman of the authority in Egypt also said that as of noon on March 31st, 285 cargo ships had passed through the canal smoothly, and the remaining 175 would pass through the canal by April 2nd. The Suez Canal is the shortest trade route between Europe and Asia and has been in operation since 1869 and is still expanding with new canals opening. Before then, ships had to take the longer route around Africa. James Gregson is a desk officer in the Australian offshore oil and gas industry and has crossed through the Suez Canal and says that the journey would normally take a day and that precautions against pirates are often also arranged.
It's quite an experience. It all starts basically, for me it started Sri Lanka, where we had to pick up armed guards to get through the, basically past Somalia, and then as you go through the Gulf of Aden, and then you get this bottleneck called the Bab el Mandeb, and that's, I remember coming up on watch, started at midday, I was on the 12 to 4 watch, and I came up on the bridge and everyone was white, and I was like, oh, what's happened? And out the back window of the bridge, there was all these skiffs, and they, the people handing over to me were like, we've just been circled for the last half an hour by 12 pirate skiffs. So that was, yeah, thankfully with armed guards, though, they scared them away, and the Somali pirates sort of know that bullets hurt, so they just wait for the next ship to come along that don't have armed guards. So that sort of is where it kind of started. And then you come up through the Red Sea, and I remember we came to the anchorage to wait for our turn at the middle of the night, and we had to drop anchor, and then we waited for our time spot and for our pilot to come. And then we embarked on our voyage, and it was still quite early, and then I remember we had to make it into the Bitter Lakes, which is about the halfway point, and you don't really see too much at night time, but when the sun came up, it was a bit like Lawrence of Arabia, you know, the rolling sand hills and everything, and then and you see the occasional palm trees and things like that. But when the most amazing part for me was when it split into the two channels, and you could see the ships on the other side, that you couldn't see the ship, all you could see was like the containers moving along the horizon, which is quite surreal, and by that stage it was the sun was setting, so it was just this big picturesque moment that I'll never forget, seeing these container ships cruising along the what looked like cities moving along the horizon. Yeah, it was quite amazing experience for me.
However, with one ship inauspiciously turning sideways, blocking the canal, questions about supply chains and the broader impact of disruption to trade routes are on the forefront of people's minds. Rob O'Brien, CEO of Logistics Bureau, a logistics and supply chain consultant company, says that the blocking of the canal is an extremely rare occurrence and that the impact of the Ever Given will last for the next few months as manufacturers make up for the lost time at sea.
I suppose the difficulty with something like this is, you know, it's yet another one of these sort of black swan events that it's very difficult to plan for. And I don't think anyone really expected, you know, the Suez Canal to be blocked for so long. So this is where you saw, you know, very large build-up of ships, because obviously they expected it might be a delay of, you know, a couple of days. And then as time went on, people are wondering, you know, should we redirect our ships and incur, you know, the extra sailing time and cost and further delays, or do we actually wait and see if the canal will reopen? I mean, I think the, you know, the canal authorities did an amazing job to actually get it cleared. It was a heck of a thing to try and tackle. But of course, it's created now this huge knock-on effect. I mean, ships are going through the canal again now, but what it's done, it's going to create, if you like, this wave effect of where shipping is going to be backing up now at all the destination ports. So in Europe for the northbound traffic, you know, around Asia and so on for the southbound traffic. And it's going to take a very long time to clear that, because obviously the ports can't take, you know, a sudden influx of ships. And, you know, where you've got ships going to the west coast of the US, for example, there's already congestion there. So I would predict, you know, there'll be 4 or 5 months before a lot of this settles down.
He also says that this will add to the growing movement of supply chains to diversify and foolproof themselves from disruption.
Yeah, look, I mean, the whole philosophy of supply chain management in recent years has been to minimise resupply times, as you say, the sort of just-in-time supply, cutting inventory levels all the way through the supply chain. I think we've already taken a backward step from that through, you know, the last 12 months or so of COVID, because we've seen disruption of resupply, and therefore that fragility that we'd kind of created in our supply chains really was a bit risky and not quite sustainable. So we're probably seeing a little bit more inventory, you know, stock levels in our supply chains now, a little bit more of a cautious approach on you know, our resupply generally. This is another factor maybe to take into account.
Rob O'Byrne, CEO of Logistics Bureau, ending that report by Sophia Tarek.
If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
Well, there's never been a better time to fly, according to the federal government, with Canberra's subsidised half-price flights for interstate destinations currently on sale. 13 regional areas are included as part of the government's $1.2 billion tourism support package that hopes to fill the void left by international border closures with domestic travellers. Talia Craft has the story.
Today, the government-subsidised half-priced flights for interstate travel went on sale. 13 regional areas, including Cairns and the Sunshine Coast, are included in the government's $1.2 billion tourism support package that hopes to fill the void left by international border closures and bring a much-needed boost to the tourism and aviation sector. Its release comes the day that Brisbane emerges out of its snap COVID lockdown ahead of the Easter long weekend. Daniel Gudwind is the chief executive of the Queensland Tourism Industry Council. He says the timing of the much anticipated flight packages is bittersweet.
Well, the timing turns out to be fortuitous. So it is coinciding with the easing of restrictions, the lifting of the lockdown in Brisbane. And that's very, very good news at the last minute, virtually. So we're very happy with that. And we hope that many consumers will be encouraged to take up those subsidised airfares now and fly to many destinations in Queensland.
Daniel Gudwind says the Brisbane snap lockdown has decreased travellers' confidence in booking interstate trips with the uncertainty over border closures.
Well, it's a big problem for our industry, of course, when the doubts are in consumers' minds about their travel plans, about their capacity to go back home and get back to work without restrictions. It has been a big concern. It remains a big concern. And, of course, the recent lockdown in Brisbane didn't help. It introduced further uncertainty, and it certainly put the fear into tourism operators across Queensland about the Easter situation. When Easter is definitely a very important time for us any year, but this year, Easter hopefully will mark a recovery of the industry and a slow path out of a crisis that's been going on for a very long time for many businesses. And we hope now with this last-minute reprieve, we can reactivate the Easter business and bring some joy to tourism operators and to the visitors that they will service.
Peter Morrison is the owner and manager of Cairns Central Travel. He says these flight deals, which are purchased online, won't give his agency the desperately needed boost it requires to stay afloat.
I wasn't that excited because it's cheaper to book them online than going through a travel agent. Great for tourism, bad for travel agents.
Mr. Morrison says the latest COVID cluster in Brisbane and forced lockdown has left their agency reeling.
If I had a $40,000 booking to Broome that I had to cancel.
Regional tourism took another hit with the announcement that Blues Fest in Byron Bay, New South Wales, would not be going ahead over the Easter long weekend due to fears over the Brisbane COVID-19 outbreak. Amani and her boyfriend Marley were buying gumboots on the way to the Blues and Roots Festival when they found out their Easter travel plans wouldn't be going ahead.
Well, we were standing in Bunnings because we were about to buy gumboots because we heard it would be raining at the festival. And first of all, my dad called me and then my grandma called me. And then we had a bunch of people actually on the phone to Babs. Well, we were talking to Belinda on the phone to Babs as well. And we were looking at everyone's Twitters, actually. Whose Twitter were you looking at?
I just did a quick Google search and, you know, heaps of reporters were saying Justin, Blues Fest cancelled.
That was it, really. Yeah, we were pretty devastated because we've had these tickets for 2 years. This is the second year.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't, ultimately Sydney, but by this point we were already near Taree, so 5 hours or so away.
Yeah. And will you still be staying in the Byron area, or will you be heading more north now? Or
no, we'll avoid Byron for a while, I think.
There's going to be a lot of...
Daniel Giswind says many people have been left disappointed by having their Easter long weekend holiday plans cancelled.
Yeah, but clearly the loss of the Blues Festival for the second time, for the second year in a row, is a devastating blow, I'm sure, for the organisers and the people who had intended to attend and the community more broadly. I mean, it just is another illustration just how important the tourism industry is and how important events are, cultural events, entertainment events, to get the community going. It's a sad blow for them and a very unfortunate casualty. The flight packages, the previous JobKeeper support and all the state government's measures in Queensland for the industry were critical. We would have a real catastrophe on our hands without that support, and that's why we're urging ongoing support. We know in figures recently released by the Federal Tourism Research Australia that the domestic tourism sector in Australia across the country lost $44 billion compared to 2019. $44 billion were lost out of domestic tourism in 2020, which leaves an enormous gap, not just to the overall economy as one big number, but in tens of thousands of businesses who were left short in their revenue in 2020. That's an enormous gap to make up, and it'll take us a long time. So we need all the support, and we need definitely an enthusiastic response from domestic travellers to take advantage of just the great country we live in and the great opportunities we have in Australia at the moment. It will be the one thing that will save us eventually.
That was Daniel Gishman, CEO of Queensland Tourism Industry Council, ending that report by Talia Craft. Well, that's all we have time for On the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to producers Talia Craft, Toby Hemmings, Sophia Tarek, and executive producer Max Stillman. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. New episodes are coming out every week. To follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2ser. I'm Max Stillman. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
free up Betty White.